And 107.5 FM, W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria. All of your utility companies across the West offering cost-saving tips to homeowners who are trying to keep cool in an historic heat wave.
Once the temperatures start to rise, shut your windows, shut your drapes, and the darker you can make it to prevent that sunlight from coming in, that's going to help reduce your overall cost and keep the temperature in your home lower naturally without having to use your air conditioner.
Jeff Smith with PG&E. Beau Biden's widow, Hallie, told jurors in Hunter Biden's gun trial how she found the revolver in his truck, put it in a leather pouch, stuffed it into a shopping bag, and tossed it into a trash can near their home. The White House is expected tomorrow to announce a new package of military aid to Ukraine. Firefighters are battling a blaze at the Atlanta Eagle and Kodak buildings, which were built in 1898 and 1905. An apology from police in Burlington, Vermont, to high school students who were terrified by a mock shooting, a training exercise that students were not told was staged. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Seven pro-Palestine protesters are under arrest after disturbing the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents meeting today in Milwaukee. It's part of their ongoing efforts to get universities to cut ties with Israel. Former Waupun prison warden Randall Hepp and eight former guards and nurses are charged with felonies in connection with 2 out of 4 inmate deaths in the last year. Dodge County Sheriff Dale Schmidt.
There must be accountability for the actions and inactions of state employees. As the sheriff, I am angered at how these men were treated and how they died.
One inmate died of malnourishment. Another was dead for 12 hours before anyone noticed. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Every business faces challenges, but complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping shouldn't be one of them.
With USPS Ground Advantage from the United States Postal Service, you can avoid all the noise.
No more unexpected surcharges, hidden fees, or complex rate structures.
It's just easy, cost-effective, and dependable shipping. Tune your business's frequency to success and turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
You're listening to Lake Air WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Quite interesting bit of video popped out by Donald Trump. Or I should say, convicted felon Donald Trump. But he put out a video claiming that Vladimir Putin would release Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich for him. And only him. And only if he wins the election in November. And he said, you know, Vladimir Putin will do that for me, and I don't believe he'll do it for anyone else. And I got to tell you, I got this weird vibe. I got this weird Iran, Reagan, hostage, gimmicky kind of vibe. And look, it made me go, you know, have they had a conversation? Has Trump and Putin put their heads together, figured out how to get him elected again? And look, I think the American people need to know. Is there a secret deal? Is there a Reagan-Iran deal? Because if you remember, and I do, 1981, January 20th, Reagan puts his hand on the Bible. And miraculously, the hostages are running free. They're released the second that he does it, in a real show of symbolism. And now we look back and we know that that was all a staged kind of thing. In fact, you know, the hostage takers were trying to, from what we understand, trying to get rid of them for a while because it wasn't working. But it was a good bit of political theater. And from an actor, it was really, you know, he hit the mark. So I got this weird vibe from this Trump thing. Because, look, he needs to do something. He needs, the number's not good. Not good. Which is why he's going to meet with the folks at the Business Roundtable. So, you know, several days after he's convicted of a felon, he's going to meet with the CEOs of the top corporations. What is it, 192 top CEOs of the big corporations? That's going to happen on June 13th. And what's interesting to me is I put the Business Roundtable almost in the terrorist class, because they can bring this country to its knees anytime they want. It's their policies that have been horribly destructive for working people over the last 40, 50 years. And I know my right-wing conspiracy friends and my left-wing conspiracy friends, my conspiracy crowd, you know, they love to throw out the Rothschilds and the Illuminati and the Bilderbergs and the New World Order and the Trilateral Commission. You never hear them talk about the Business Roundtable and the kind of power that these outweighed power that these companies have, that this organization has, because they get what they want. So Trump going there, you got to wonder what he's going to sell them, what he's going to promise to give to them, and what they're going to be able really to extract out of him, anything they want, because he is coming desperate on bended knee. Now, interestingly enough, we got a bunch of rich guys running for Senate. See, I used to say politics was the new polo. Rich people needed something to dabble in, to play with, but not anymore dabbling. They're now running for office. And on Tuesday in Montana, you had the GOP primary, where Tim Sheehy's victory has put him in as one of the rich guys running for Senate. You put him, Dave McCormick, here in Pennsylvania where I'm at, this Eric Hovde from Wisconsin, and that Bernie Marino selling the Chinese cars in Ohio. So you got four really, really rich guys who don't have a clue on how government works, but they know they're smart. They got money. They get what they want. And this is why working people don't get the things that they need. You know, I saw this story the other day on CBS Morning. Such a feel-good story. And look, these are feel-good stories, and we do need them. But it was of a woman in Louisiana who saw a 90-year-old veteran pushing carts in the supermarket parking lot. And, you know, she sprung into action. You know, she went and took out her phone, shot a video, and put it on social media, and got the guy, you know, almost $250,000. And at no point in this wonderful feel-good story, look, it is a good story. It is a good heart-wrenching story of people who do want to do something. And I do believe we're a country that desperately wants to do something to help our neighbors. So it is. It tugs at the heartstrings that people reached into their pockets in this day with inflation high and wages not going up fast enough to say, hey, this 90-year-old guy who's been pushing carts for 23 years in Louisiana, in the heat, that they reached in their pockets and they sent this guy some money to make sure that he's going to do okay. Now, the weird thing is you know, he said, yeah, he's going to give money to the church and he's not going to quit working. But it's going to make him, how did he put it? He can now work without worrying. Because when she asked him why he was pushing carts, he said to eat. And when you get into the economics of what they talked about, here's a guy whose Social Security is only $1,100 a month, but his bills to live are like $2,500. So he's got to go out there and hustle for more. And this is where you keep coming back to. We have a broken system in this country. We have a broken system that doesn't allow working people the knowledge that in old age, they're not going to be working till the day they drop. Now, this guy had the mentality that, you know, he was going to work because if you're not working, you know, what do you have to live for? There's a lot of people who think that way. I'm probably one of them. But shouldn't that be an option, not a mandate? Shouldn't that be something that you want to do as opposed to, no, in order for me to survive, I've got to be out here in 100-degree heat pushing shopping carts that somebody else didn't put back. And at no point did they talk about the wages and the retirement security that isn't there for working people, not just his generation, because they actually had it pretty good. They actually, a good majority of the workforce did have Social Security, a divine benefit pension, the money that they were able to save, were able to ride the wave of inflation of the 70s to be able to grow some wealth, but not for everybody. And at no point did I hear anything in this such a feel-good story of, you know, this one guy's not alone. They make these things sound like it's in isolation. Oh, this woman is so wonderful because she saw this one guy and, you know, and she wanted to help. This is where, for me, policy matters. This is where politics matters. And am I surprised that the new News Nation Decision Desk HQ poll finds that 58% of registered voters say they're living paycheck to paycheck? No. And that nearly 45 of them are saying they're worse off than they were a year ago? No, I'm not surprised by that at all, because we've lost our bargaining power in this country. We've lost what brought us together and built the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. And how? Well, the business roundtable is a big part of that. And a media structure that props up these feel-good stories, not going to tell you about the organizing campaigns that are going on or the obscene profits that the business roundtable are lining their pockets with while blaming Biden for the inflation that they're causing. So am I surprised that the news media is now, you know, finding other ways to make the Trump-Biden horse race possible? I saw one this morning, the double haters. This is a new category, the double haters. They hate both. Now that Trump's a felon, they don't want Trump, but they also hate Biden. So they might vote for someone else because we got to make it about a horse race. When the reality is this campaign should be about Biden winning in a landslide because of what he has done. The policies that to make working people's lives better, what he has accomplished. That's what we should be talking about. But no, we can't do that because we got to make up double haters. And that's because, well, our business roundtable folks, the moneyed interests, they want what they want and they're going to get it. Look, you know, Trump's going to go and he's going to sit down with the big wigs and they're going to twist his arm. Because understand, while he was president, they didn't always get what they wanted. Trust me, this time they will. And again, for me, it comes back to, yeah, I look at this 90-year-old guy and yeah, we got to help this guy. And the million plus more that are just like him. And this again is where policy matters, because for every, this guy, this cart pusher in Louisiana, for every one of him, where one person said, hey, I'm gonna shoot this social media thing and it's going to get attention. There are another million people out there who are trying to figure out how to just make it to tomorrow. And this isn't new. And it's not only someone else. It's probably in your family. It's probably going to be one of us at some point. So for me, it comes back down to policy. What are we doing to make people's lives better? What are the politicians telling us that they're going to do, and how do we hold them accountable when they tell us what they're going to do? How do we get to that point? For me, it's about elections, pure and simple. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. When we come back, Republicans at it again, going after the attempt to repeal the 20th century. Back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So on Wednesday, Senate Republicans killed legislation that would have created a federal right for women to access birth control. And look, no surprise here. No surprise the Republicans are against women. And according to The Hill, I love their argument, they said the bill was unnecessary and overly broad. Unnecessary because, you know, I think they're only attacking, you know, women's right to access birth control in about 10 states right now. Maybe it's going to come to more. And the overly broad part, the question is how narrow should it be that women could access birth control and protect themselves? Quite remarkable. The vote, 51-39. You had two Republicans vote in favor, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, nowhere near the 60 needed for cloture. So this is, in essence, dead. But, you know, look, as a messaging bill, women, wake up. That's why I've asked Laura Packard to come share some thoughts. She's the executive director of Healthcare Voter, their website, healthcarevoter.org. Laura, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, are we surprised by this outcome? Are we surprised that the Republicans were all in lockstep saying, even the female Republicans, no, this isn't a right you should have?
Well, much like what Susan Collins would say, we were disappointed. Because whether or not we saw this coming, it still came. And you would think that you would get 90% of the Senate to vote with 90% of what Americans want, which is supporting birth control. But apparently that was too much.
No, see, because the weird thing here is, you're right, 90% of the country goes, yeah, this is how we stop abortions. We don't get people pregnant to start with. We protect people from the beginning, and we don't have unwanted pregnancies. This seems like a no-brainer.
Yes, and also, this is not just a woman's issue. Unplanned pregnancy and unplanned parenthood is a both partners issue. So this affects men, too. And again, this is why 90% of Americans support birth control. So it's really shocking when you think about it that Republicans couldn't bring themselves to support this bill. And that's because their donors don't like it.
Yeah. So let's go back to this argument that it was unnecessary and the legislation was overly broad. There is this head in the sand thought. Well, you know, we haven't finished attacking it yet. We haven't overturned Griswold yet. So it's unnecessary because the bad thing hasn't really, really happened to you yet. So basically, just if I'm getting this right, it's just, well, wait till we actually do something to you before you defend yourself.
Exactly. And in Project 2025, you know, they've already telegraphed that their agenda is to go after birth control. They just haven't succeeded yet. And we saw with this radical Supreme Court taking away rights that we had taken for granted for decades, the right to an abortion and reproductive health care, that this Supreme Court could change their minds in a minute. And Friday is the anniversary of the Griswold versus Connecticut decision that set the foundation for your access to birth control in the first place. And we cannot take that for granted because they could just as easily take it away.
Yeah, I go back to John Roberts being confirmed as Chief Justice, saying that he believed in decided law, stare decisis, and he was only going to call balls and strikes. The strike zone seems to have gotten a lot weirder when you see the kind of precedent that has been in place for decades being just tossed aside.
Absolutely. And so none of us can take for granted that rights that for my whole life I have had access to birth control cannot assume that going forward that things will be the same tomorrow that they were yesterday, because we've seen this radical Supreme Court and these enabling legislators allow it to happen.
So let me ask you the question I asked at the beginning. because the other argument is that the legislation that the Democrats came for, overly broad. How narrow should this be decided? And you know, quite honestly, you know, with Griswold in place, how narrow is it now, and how much more narrow do they want it to be that maybe they would vote for something in the future?
Well, this bill just established the right to contraception. So, I mean, some people on Twitter and elsewhere have said, oh, this allows, you know, this would make people pay for it. No, this is nothing about, this just establishes that you can get birth control. It doesn't change anything about insurance or how you pay for it. It also doesn't cover abortion. It doesn't cover gender affirming care. Like, none of the things that they're throwing out there to say why they're against this bill cover this bill, because this is a pretty narrow bill. Do you have a right to contraception or not? So,
see, that seems simple. That seems really simple. Yeah. The answer, yes.
Right, but they don't want to make that argument. So they're throwing other things out there, trying to distract and hide the fact that they can't make the answer that most people want to hear, which is, yes, I support contraception.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. Now, the Supreme Court, any day now, could come up with a decision between now and the end of this term, I guess late June, early July, that some have told me that may not even be decided this time. But it's this, what, mifepristone, I guess is what it's called, this fight over access to this, which I guess is used in more than 6 in 10 abortions in the country. Is this part of what was happening yesterday, or is this something separate?
Well, mifepristone is one of the two pills that's used for a medication abortion. And so that is a separate issue from birth control, because birth control is not abortion. And that's also something that some of these right-wing figures are trying to confuse. Birth control is before the pregnancy. Abortion is after you become pregnant. But mifepristone, the Supreme Court may rule that one of the safe drugs that the FDA has regulated for decades, they will take it off the market for political reasons. And this is purely about their ideology. It's not about whether a drug is safe or not. And clearly, the justices are not MDs. They should be nowhere near deciding which drugs are safe or not. We have agencies with trained professionals to make that decision. This is just a radical Supreme Court choosing to legislate their personal beliefs onto the rest of us.
Well, for now, we have experts in those regulatory bodies, and people who've, you know, spent their entire lives and careers gaining knowledge to be able to be in those positions. If Trump wins 2025, the Heritage Foundation gets their way, you know, maybe we get guys who yesterday was working on a hot dog cart deciding what drugs women are should and should not have.
Exactly. And one of the Heritage folks I saw tweeted today about how I was a part of Americans for Contraception. We had a giant 20-foot IUD in downtown Washington, D.C. to remind the senators of what's at stake today while they voted. And so one of the Heritage staffers tweeted about how this was unnecessary, irrelevant. You know, like, this vote doesn't matter. This issue doesn't matter. But they are exactly the kind of people that are going to come after your contraception as soon as they are back in office.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter to whoever tweeted it out, but it matters to a lot of people across this country. And look, as you know, as the parent of two, one daughter moving into childbearing years, and one eventually, hopefully, will down the road, coming into those years, I want them to be able to choose when they have children. I want them to be able to ensure that they have control of their bodies and their futures, and not be forced into situations not of their choosing. So for me, this is it's not a me issue. I want my kids to be safe. I've said this about abortion. I'm not a pro-abortion person. I'm a pro-safety person. I don't want, you know, bad things to happen. So for me, the idea of stopping those things from happening before bad things happen, I'm all on board with.
And also, the contraception is not just about birth control. I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind. It's the most obvious thing. But people use birth control, pills, IUDs, patches, shots, all of the different things for various medical conditions, for managing chronic conditions and endometriosis, perimenopause, menopause symptoms, and so on, as well as condoms to prevent sexually transmitted infections and so on. So this isn't just about whether you can get pregnant and whether you want to have a planned pregnancy. It's also about health, because again, this is all part of healthcare. And these legislators and the Supreme Court should not be determining what healthcare you and I can get or not.
No, this is an excellent point, because, you know, now I'm thinking about, you know, if they do overturn Griswold and contraception is not a right, then do you have to start making arguments that it's for things other than what it's for? And do you end up in this weird kind of twisted world of people having to lie about what they're using these drugs for? What happened to get the government out of our lives? What happened to get the government out between me and my doctor? What happened to that?
Well, I would like to see this particular Supreme Court get out of my uterus, because they don't belong there. And they should not be making decisions that determine what parts of healthcare we get access to or not. And our Congress should not be determining that either. They should vote for this common sense legislation, you know, right to contraception. And next week they'll be voting on IVF, and they should be voting to enshrine these as rights for everybody, and not deciding what procedures you can or can't get. It's just madness.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. It's crazy where we are. And ultimately, and I know you're a nonprofit, but ultimately, this has got to come back to the political realm. This has got to come back to voters saying, the 90% of us who think that this should be safe and legal and able to be gotten. This is where I think we have to hold people accountable.
Mm-hmm. And healthcare voter is all about educating people so that when you vote, you can take into consideration people's records on healthcare, and you can be a healthcare voter. And Americans for Contraception especially wants to educate people what's at stake and let them know how your representative voted on contraception, because this vote just happened in the Senate. The House has a discharge petition, so the House has their chance. Your House members have a chance to vote yes or no by signing on to this discharge petition and pay attention to what they're doing.
Do you think there's any chance of the House taking a vote on this, given the fact that the Senate Republicans were almost unanimously opposed to it, with the exception of Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins? Do you think the House, mm-hmm. which is controlled by Republicans and the same, and I would argue further to the extreme religious right, do you think this mm-hmm. this sees the light of day in the House?
Well, on the one hand, yes, more extremist Republicans in the House. On the other hand, the House is so narrowly divided. You don't have a filibuster in the House either. You don't have to get to 60 to 60% of the House. If you get a simple majority on the discharge petition, then it'll get a floor vote. So this is possible in the House, because again, you're not having to get to 60%.
No. Nope.
You're having to get to 50% plus one, and that is not as hard to do in the House.
So is the argument now going forward going to be we need to get rid of the filibuster, and because 51 votes would have carried the majority on this?
Well, I mean, if we didn't have a filibuster, or we amended the filibuster, we would have protected right to abortion and reproductive health care. That would have already happened. So I hope that's something that we address in the future, because it is undemocratic that you have to get 60% of the votes for the Senate to do anything.
I got to tell you, this... I've been talking about this for about 10 years now. I'm going, look, they want to overturn Roe. They want to go after Griswold. They want to go after Loving. They want to go they want to repeal the 20th century. So all mm-hmm. of that legislation that created that life, liberty, pursuit of happiness thing that we were told to believe in, they want to repeal all that stuff. And this is just one more step. So the frustrating part for me is we've seen this slow train coming. We know what the next move is. And I would hope people get angry about this and we'll take it out on the people who have done it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why we have to keep talking about these issues and educating people, because how many people don't know that their senators just voted against their right to birth control? We need to make sure people know that and can act accordingly, because I think there's a huge gulf with mainstream media, fewer and fewer people subscribing to their daily paper or watching news, and where people are getting news instead on social media and from friends and neighbors may not be the most accurate and fact-based news sometimes. So it's on us to keep sharing the facts so that people know what's going on.
There you go. Laura Packard, I appreciate you taking time for us. Keep up the fight. I know you will, and I hope you'll come back and share some more with us down the road.
Thank you much.
Laura Packard, Executive Director of Healthcare Voter. Check out their website, healthcarevoter.org. We'll get links out on social media. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Surprised by the Republicans? Surprised by this at all? You shouldn't be. Shouldn't be. Surprised by Trump? He takes credit for it. Want to hear your thoughts? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Gradual clearing in the overnight as lows settle back into the upper 40s to near 50 degrees and a gusty west to northwest wind. Quite a bit of sunshine to close out your work week. Northwest winds, afternoon highs will reach the middle 70s, currently 59 degrees.
Finding the special healthcare resources families need just got easier. Wisconsin Wayfinder, Children's Resource Network, helps kids with delays, disabilities, special healthcare needs, and mental health conditions. Call toll-free 877-947-2929. Ask questions, get answers. Connect today toll-free, 877-947-2929. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, big news this week in the labor world. And truthfully, something I've had a number of conversations with over the last several weeks, and it dropped on Tuesday. The Amazon Labor Union has agreed to affiliate with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Look, it seems like the logical choice, but given the fact that ALU has been quoted by a number of unions, it could have gone either way. And for me, this could be a coup. This could be a great thing. This could be the step that gets, well, all of Amazon eventually under one master agreement where we're saving the world. Or it could be, honestly, a giant resource suck. And here to share some thoughts on maybe where this goes and what it took to get here, I've asked our good friend Randy Corgan to come talk with us. Randy's the president of Teamsters Local 1932, secretary, treasurer, and principal officer. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure. Appreciate you having me on.
So this seems to me kind of like a big deal. So, you know, my mind immediately goes, is this the coup that I think it is? Or is this, do you think, possibly a giant money suck?
Look, you know, I don't have a crystal ball to predict the future, but I can tell you that it is a natural partnership that should happen. I think that any of these spaces in which workers are collectively coming together to build worker power and demand, big corporations like Amazon come up to some sort of industry standard, that being in a space that we are connected to or in charge of or moving in that direction, you know, builds strength towards, you know, and homage to our 100 years of experience in this industry. And I think that, ALU recognizes that this has been a tough undertaking, and it's very hard as an independent startup union. It's hard enough for unions to succeed in this space, first and foremost. Secondarily, then being a startup organization. And, you know, we've really worked hard to build relationships in these communities naturally within the industry, within the workers, within community leaders and elected leaders. And that just naturally, you know, synergizes into something like this. And, you know, really got to praise the general president and the general executive board and the all departments that work together to slowly kind of bring this into the right space. Everybody worked really hard to make sure it wasn't competitive, that it wasn't, you know, negative, and that whatever opportunity can be seized there is seized there. If ALU stuck on its own and stayed on its own, it's, you know, highly likely that it's not going to be able to succeed just from a resource situation. They're just not going to have the resource that's necessary. And you know, they had their internal struggles that were becoming very, very public. And those things, as we are well aware of what internal political struggles do, imagine it tearing you apart when you're just an upstart organization. And so I think the stability of our organization and our ability, you know, in New York, we've already been on the ground with thousands and thousands of workers, thousands of members, and hundreds of people within the community. We're already occupying this space. So now just putting it under one banner is really, really good step.
No. And the reason, because the reason I asked about a resource suck is, look, you know, you said there's some internal turmoil, some strife going on there, some things going on that the stability the Teamsters would bring would be immensely helpful. But, you know, also it is a startup. It has a struggle taking on one of the biggest corporations on the planet. And doing it in a way, and this is why I thought this was a great idea, especially with you involved, is because we've had these conversations over the years about the kind of organizing that Chris Smalls and his group did, that kind of ground grassroots, member focused, worker focused organizing. And immediately I thought, you know, Randy's got to have his hands on this.
You know, we could have dropped cards in that situation years ago, knowing what was going on, but we weren't going to depend on the NLRB process to bail the recognition out. And ALU decided to move in that direction. They clearly won the election. And as a result of that, you know, there's still certification that hasn't been finalized because Amazon is still pushing back. And clearly Amazon is using all of its resources to just prevent the first step of actually starting to bargain a contract. Yeah. And so obviously our organization can help move that along. Your question about whether it's going to be a resource suck or not, you know, that's my responsibility. That's the general president's responsibility. That's something that we're going to work very hard at making sure that we're going to maximize the output of that. And are we going to put some resources into it? Absolutely. Are we going to put more than are necessary? No. What that means, there's still a lot to evaluate. The group, number one, has got to ratify this. I'm assuming they're going to. We know the workers on the ground. We have known the workers on the ground, even when they went through their ALU election, a couple years ago. And we have to evaluate, you know, what those strategic advantages are. And there are a lot of ways, without me disclosing all those strategic advantages that we currently have right now, there are a lot of ways to tie that in with what we're already doing.
No, and that's important. Now, look, you know, JFK 8 is the only unionized facility in the entire Amazon chain. This is that toe in the water, so to speak, and a great opportunity to get that first contract. But given how broken our labor laws are, and how now you have the Amazons and the Trader Joe's and the rest of them trying to overturn the NLRA, this seems to be kind of an uphill battle, doesn't it?
Absolutely. But understand something, we're not depending on the National Labor Relations Act to bail this stuff out. What we're doing is the one issue I'll disagree with you on as far as ALU, grassroots organizing, they still filed an NLRB election. And that process, depending on the broken system of the NLRB to rescue workers at being represented, is clearly been broken for decades. And now that there's this influx in this in-between space, it's time to challenge workers into direct action and challenge them in a way that they take control of the shop floor, not just organize around the shop floor, but but take control of the shop floor like we have all over the country. And when you synergize this potentially there, there's a lot of good possibilities. And it's called ramping it up a bit and making sure that that direct action leads to a contract.
No, ultimately, that's the goal, to make lives better, right? But it's that direct action that we've seen in other places. That can it be replicated in other places? Can you do more of what you've been doing?
Well, we are seeing that. We've already done more. There's been more than 40 extensions of pickets out of Palmdale extended all over the country. What we've seen is majority of workforces walk off the job in support of those pickets. Those workforces have demanded things from Amazon and achieved them in those locations. And as that continues to build out more and more in all of these metropolitan areas, workers are becoming more and more bold about and recognizing, not just bold, but recognizing this is a pathway to hold them accountable, that it's not a futile process. The NLRB a lot of times is a futile process. What's not a futile process is when workers, let's say a couple days ago, pulled a mayor in one part of the country, sat the mayor down of a city that their facility is in, broke down all the laws in which the employer was violating. The mayor has committed to sitting down with Amazon and saying, look, we need to sit down and solve these problems. You can't be doing this in our city to the people that live and work in our city. And when you have partners like that, that are willing to hold a corporation accountable on that level, I'm not going to say what city that's in yet. That's going to come out in probably the next three or four weeks. And what that level of direct action does is it's going to shift Amazon a bit back, because at the end of the day, they're not only being held accountable by the workers, but other workers in the industry and then elected officials. At some point, there's no place for them to hide anymore.
So what you're really talking about is the kind of organizing my grandparents' generation did. The kind of, not just in the workplace, but you know, socially, politically, all across the board, kind of demanding better opportunities through every means possible.
It's time for workers to walk off the job and demand a contract, not demand a fix to this area, this issue. It's time for workers to start walking off the job, not just demand recognition, but demand a contract, not demand to sit and bargain, to demand a contract. And apparently some of these corporations are not going to pay attention until that operation is, you know, held hostage by the workers. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that legitimately. The workers perform the work. And if the only way for these workers to catch this employer's attention, or any employer's attention, is to stop working and say, we're not going back to work until you give us these things that we believe are reasonable within the industry.
Yeah, I had an old timer right when I first started working. In fact, probably first couple of weeks on the job, he said, you know, the only power that you have is the power to put your hands in your pockets and walk your feet. And that's basically what you're talking about. The power that workers have is, you know, we're not going to keep working in desperate conditions. We're not going to keep working for poverty wages. And we have seen that where this has been successful.
It has been successful in a lot of places. And I know the problem is the media doesn't want to report, you know, these types of things. They continue to gravitate towards NLRB filings. They gravitate towards what corporate America decides is organizing. Organizing, workers organizing, is workers coming together, building worker power, and taking direct action and with a set of demands. And those demands, not, you know, being unreasonable, that they should be within reasonable, you know, sort of demands for that employer, then the employer saying we can accommodate those. We're just, you know, as a whole society, I think workers are starting to get over that hump. We've seen this on small scale. We know this is what actually formed the labor movement in America to begin with. You just referenced, you know, our grandparents' era and that generation, which did this type of work. But many will state, if you read the memoirs and you read a lot of things that were said when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, many organizers absolutely opposed the act being passed in 1934 and 1935. As a matter of fact, organizers that organized like we're talking about ignored the National Labor Relations Act into the 1940s. And it wasn't until 47 that they started to kind of get forced to do things in a slightly different way, because they didn't want to be handcuffed by the process under the National Labor Relations Act. Ultimately, getting back to workers taking direct action, taking control of the shop floor, and controlling their destiny and controlling their future.
No, it's an important step, and I'm hoping this is part of that, because, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about here on the program, we see what happened in Alabama with the UAW, and one of the critiques I made was, I don't know that we've sufficiently laid the groundwork for the kind of organizing that needs to happen by changing hearts and minds. We've had 50 years of right-wing, anti-worker, pro-corporate messaging that's been pounded into workers, and it's going to take a little time to get people back to the idea that you can affect change, not just in the workplace, but in your communities, by workers coming together. So this seems to me to be a really exciting moment and a really, really exciting opportunity for not just the Teamsters, but for the entire labor movement.
Look, you said it. It takes time to build that out. It takes time to educate a community. It takes time to educate all the leaders within that community and the workforce in that community. It takes time to knock on all those doors. It takes time to connect all those dots. It's not a magic wand that you wave and it happens in, you know, 6 months or a year or two. It takes some time. Now, some areas will move faster than others. But at the end of the day, you are 100% correct, Rick. That is what needs to happen. And what I'm excited about doing this for more than 30 years. This is the first time under this administration, this is the first time that our organization has been this aggressive and assertive in giving us the ability to touch these pressure points. Previous administrations always shut me down in this space. And I just gotta say that it's refreshing for me, because I would not be doing this and I would not be in this position, because I got asked, not just by the previous administration, but the current administration, to lead it. I wouldn't be doing it if it was go in, drop cards, file for an election, and go through that process that everybody's fallen into that mistake the last 50 years. The great thing is this administration has absolutely moved in the right direction on this subject, and seeing all things, you know, moving and working in unison with one another, where the entire organization is in unison with one another to make this happen. I can't tell you all the things we're doing internally, because
you gotta hold your cards close to your vest. Strategies. I get it.
Yeah.
You play your card when you need to play it. But I'm excited by this.
It's coming. I'm telling you, it's coming. And you would not see me this assertive if I didn't see, you know what kind of organizer I am. You know what I've been doing for 30 years, Rick. We've known each other for a very long time. And you know the work on the ground that I absolutely do. And I'm telling you, it's coming.
No, I'm excited about this, because, look, we see what comes out of Amazon. We see the high injury rates. We see the low pay. We see all of the things that are going on there. And there is truly an opportunity to make lives better. So I'm excited by this announcement. I'm excited about what is yet to come. And I hope you will come and share those things with us as you play those cards, because I think this is a great opportunity. And I got to tell you, Randy, looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I think that ALU has seen that those leaders within that organization we've shared some of that stuff with them, and they see that opportunity, which is why we closed the gap and we're able to build that partnership correctly.
There you go. Randy Corrigan, I appreciate you taking time for us. Always great. Again, looking forward to getting you back here to give us some more Teamsters Local 1932 Secretary Treasurer. Make sure you check out their website, teamsters1932.org. Randy, thanks so much, buddy.
Thanks, Rick.
I take a quick break. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you excited about the prospect of maybe taking on this behemoth and making these the good family-sustaining jobs that working people in this country need? I know I am. I know a lot of my friends want to keep shopping with Amazon. It'd be great to be able to do so, knowing that the jobs that are being created are helping our neighbors, our friends, maybe even ourselves. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, And this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day that the Colorado State Militia troops came to Cripple Creek to intervene in a mining strike. But unlike every other time in U.S. mining history that a state militia was called out, the Colorado State troops did not have their guns pointed at the miners. Instead, Colorado's populist governor David Waite had ordered the troops to the area because he was concerned by the large private army of gun thugs the mining company was amassing. Cripple Creek was in gold mining country at the base of Pike's Peak. In February, the mine operators had declared that the miners would have to work a 10-hour workday for 8 hours of wages. The miners could stay on the 8-hour schedule, but they would have to take a 17% pay cut. Outraged, the miners walked out of the mine. The Western Federation of Miners led the strike, which wore on for 5 long months with violence on both sides. The mine owners were determined to end the walkout and gathered a private gun force of more than 1,200 hired thugs. On June 5th, there was a standoff between the miners and the company hired guns at the Bull Hill Mine. Unable to take the mine, the company guns instead unleashed their anger and fury on the townspeople of Cripple Creek. They raided homes, arrested people, and beat them in the streets. In response, the governor threatened to keep the state militia in the area until the strike was settled. The mine owners knew that they were beat, opting to settle the strike, marking a major victory for the Western Federation of Miners and their members.
It is for our little children that seem to us so dear, but for us nor them dear workers, the bosses do not care.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is one of those things that you almost cannot believe, but you're going to believe it. Evidently, Donald Trump is all ripped off by the fact that none of the jurors actually smiled at him. you cannot make this up. He complained that during his hush money trial, it was unfair to him, of course. He said that, and disappointingly so, that he never saw a glimmer of a smile from the jury. Trump said, you heard me say long before the verdict that Mother Teresa couldn't get a fair trial here. I said that, and no, you couldn't. I never saw a glimmer of a smile from that jury. No, this was a venue that was very unfair. No, because these people showed up and wanted to do their jobs. And you know, we're hearing some stuff. You go, you did it. It's criminal. But again, it's all about him. It's all about his privilege. And I saw a guy do an argument that, you know, Trump is the epitome of white privilege. And there's some truth to that, but he's the epitome of wealth privilege. He's the epitome of the kind of privilege that wealthy white men have gotten. So this idea that there's white privilege, yeah, there is. But Trump is the wealthy white man privileged poster child. There's no question about that. And look, the other privileged white men and some of the women, they're doing their foolhardy best to protect Trump as well. Axios just reported that conservatives want a floor vote on a bill that would allow current or former presidents to move any state case brought against them, such as the one in New York, to a federal court. And you have Johnson, Speaker Johnson, who evidently told the Republicans in a conference meeting that the House GOP was going to go after the DOJ. Increase oversight, funding cuts, other means. You had this week Jim Jordan, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, saying that they were going to cut federal funding for state prosecutors, you know, who are investigating, you know, the ones investigating Trump. Johnson, you know, called for the Supreme Court to step in to overturn the guilty verdict of Trump. They're doing everything they can do. And it got me thinking, can you imagine how the GOP would, their minds would explode, what little's in there, how their skulls would explode if a Democrat were dumb enough to say, we want to give the president We want to vote to give the president the power to pardon anyone of state-level convictions. Because Hunter Biden's on trial right now, and there's a possibility that he's going to get found guilty. Interestingly enough, haven't heard much about the broken judiciary system around the Hunter Biden trial. No, haven't heard much from Republicans about a witch hunt. Haven't heard much of that, considering, and it's interesting, that Hunter Biden's on trial for trying to buy a gun while evidently using drugs or you know, whatever that is. And it's a crime, I think. I'm not a gun person, but I'm told it's a crime to be using drugs and to try and buy a gun and to lie on that form and all that. And he may be found guilty. I don't know. We'll see. And if he is, the system, that's how it is. He should go to jail. Maybe you could put him and Trump in the same cell. It would save you on security. But, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, they during the whole Trump trial, it's a broken system. It's a witch hunt. It's, you know, political prosecution. And yet, Hunter Biden, it seems a little political, doesn't it? And it also seems interesting that Republicans want to ease gun restrictions for veterans struggling with mental health issues. So we want to make it easier for people to do that. And the Supreme Court has a case in front of it to make it easier for people who were domestic abusers, for make it easier for them to buy guns. So it's really kind of bizarre that, you know, the positions, the pretzel that the Republican Party has twisted itself into. I find it quite interesting in that, you know, here we are looking at, much like the 2020 election, the whole thing was rigged. It was stolen. It was fraud. Well, except in our elections, the ones we won. The ones we won were perfectly above boards. You know, everyone got their say. But it was that one those we lost, because evidently Joe Biden during the pandemic became a master coder, in his basement with his mask on. You know, sleeping while doing master coding. He was able to go into those computers that most don't have internet access, and you can't do it on. But he figured it out, because Joe Biden is sleepy Super Joe. I mean, it's like being on every side of every issue, and always being right. And that's pretty much where the Republican Party finds themselves. And Trump. I mean, to be honest, Felon Trump, you know, it's always about him and only him. It's not about you or me or working people. And the Republican Party will put themselves in some of the weirdest places. For instance, Florida Representative Byron Donalds. He came out and he said, quote, "You see, during Jim Crow, the black family was together. During Jim Crow, more black people were not just conservative, because black people have always been conservative-minded, but more black people voted conservatively." This is him. This is his persuasion bit to try and get black voters to vote for Donald Trump. That Jim Crow was actually good. Jim Crow had an upside. It's the same people who make the, you know, slavery had an upside. You know, there was a good side to slavery. Now, his argument is, you know, the voters of the time who were voting for Republicans did so because Abraham Lincoln, you know, was the guy. He freed the slaves. What Byron Donalds forgets, the whole rest of the history of the country that got us to here. Yes, that Republican Party that is in no way, shape, or form anywhere remotely close to today's lunatic, fringe, fascistic Republican Party. You can see it. I would not have been a Democrat in that period. They were the party of slavery and a whole bunch of other really ugly stuff. Now, the idea here is they are going to destroy public education so we don't think about this stuff, so that we just take them at their word. And sadly, this is just bad, but not surprising. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. Something I said got under your nerves, under your skin, on all of that. I want to hear about it. And are you excited about the Amazon labor union Teamster affiliation? I am. I think this could be a good thing. I want to hear about it. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Always check out freespeech.org for our video component. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick at therickssmithshow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory. And always streaming on the